All right, welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Flushing is Burning. I'm Grace, and as always, I'm here with Christian Romo. Christian, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, but I'm also trying to figure out if the Mets are good or not. And I was wondering if you could shine a light on the topic, if you had any insight on that.
I think it's going to be hard to tell until the major pieces that are not there right now come back. They haven't looked great recently, but they haven't looked awful either.
Yeah, and I think that's something you could ascribe to a lot of teams in baseball right now. I think there are a lot of fan bases 1 month in trying to figure out if their teams are good or not, whether they've overperformed or underperformed, because I can't tell you if the Pirates are any good. I have no idea if the Marlins are good, but the Mets have the same record as the Astros, and I don't think those two teams are on the same plane. And so I guess my question is, when you look at this team, what about it can you positively ascribe as, yes, this is something that the Mets do well?
They get on base really well. Like, that's they don't have a problem with that. They can pitch the first four innings of the game reasonably well if it's one of the main starters. Past that, you know, who knows? But it's like everything is good in spurts. Where this guy had a really good game, or this guy had a really good three-game stretch, or you know, something like that. But other than, like, David Robertson and, like, Jeff McNeil's turned it on, P. Alonso's consistently looked good. Other than a few players here and that, it's been a lot of, like, spurts. Good, not good. Good, not good. Good. It's difficult to tell. And, I mean, it's a small sample, too. It's been – I think you'd have a better idea of this towards the end of May, really.
Yeah, and that's something that I think you're absolutely right about, that some more time is going to have needed to have passed in order for us to make a reasonable conclusion about how this team is. But I think you're also right in the assessment that this team gets on base really well. And beyond that, I'm not entirely sure what they do well. What I do think is constructed well about this team as they currently stand is that the offense can withstand those spurts, as you say. If there are a couple of players that are not performing up to standards, like, for instance, Pete Alonso and Francisco Lindor for about 10 days weren't hitting at all, there are enough good bats to support those spurts when things go awry. I don't know if the same thing can be said about either the starting pitching or the relief pitching, because the relief pitching right now has done what I consider to be a pretty admirable job considering the loss of their best player in Edwin Diaz. But if either David Robertson or Adam Ottavino decide to, you know, be mediocre all of a sudden, I don't think there's a recourse. I don't think there's any support. And we're seeing that right now with the starting pitching as well. It's entirely possible that all five of the pitchers that the Mets thought would comprise their starting rotation are hurt right now. And as we can see right now, there is no coming back from that. If even two or three of their 30-plus starting pitchers are hurt, there really isn't any support coming for them.
I mean, the starting pitching thing you can design a team with depth, which they did. You know, starting the season, the idea was that Peterson, McGill, Lucchese, Budo, that these guys were going to be depth. And then you got to the point where now they're the rotation. You're not designing the team with them being starters. You're designing it with them being emergency options. And when you get to the point that all of the emergency options are in your rotation or hurt, there's nowhere you can, not even the best team can withstand that, you know? Even if the Dodgers had to get down to their number 10 depth piece, it'd be starting to look a little shaky for them. You know, it's difficult to build a team to compete and then have so many major pieces get hurt, like Verlander, like Quintana, like Carrasco. Scherzer getting suspended for 10 games. Marte, I think, has been playing hurt. Canna hasn't looked himself. This is the issue with building a team that's both – that's older, is that you're going to have guys who get hurt more often. And when you do that, and the you know, there's no amount of depth that you can add to that beyond, you know, spending $600 million on this team.
Right, but that's bad design, in my opinion, then. Like, if you're constructing a starting rotation of 5 30-plus pitchers, two of them who are over 40, your depth is no longer that break glass in case of emergency option. And I'm not saying that the Mets had much of a choice, because the starting pitching options on the free agency market this past offseason were Verlander, and that's about it. And they got Verlander. They did their job in that regard. But there is a bit of a design flaw there if you don't acknowledge at the start of the season that, yeah, like, having five starting pitchers above the age of 30 is probably not a winning strategy.
And it's also, you know, the options were Verlander, who they got, DeGrom, who clearly didn't want to come back, and Rodon was the other top line starter, and he's hurt. There's nothing you can do to help that scenario right there. I think the other issue with this team is that they've built a team and given a manager that isn't going to be able to bring the best out of that team. I think if there was a different manager of this team, someone like a Kevin Cash, who's someone who's very good at sort of mixing and matching and plugging guys in perfectly, you'd be able to maximize the potential that the group has. But when you have someone like Buck Showalter, who I think is a very great guy, but, you know, seems he's lost a step this season, if he ever had that step last season, or if it was just everything broke the right way, he's managing the team like you would manage a team in like the year 2000. And that's just not going to work anymore. And David Peterson, I saw a thing online the other day that he's been told to throw his – someone's told him to throw his slider in the zone more often and to make it a worse slider. When you do these things, when your pitch design and your manager aren't working to the strengths of the team, it's never going to live up to its potential, and it's probably going to disappoint.
Well, I think that's an interesting conversation to have, because I'm not someone who understands the value – of a manager in the modern game. I believe that I have a very old school mentality of what exactly a manager brings. So I think I'd like to ask you, the Mets are 15 and 13 right now. Are they 16 and 13? They're 2-3 games above 500 at this point. How much of that do you ascribe to Buck? How much of that is the manager making poor in-game decisions, or perhaps poor personnel decisions? Like, how much of this rests on the manager?
I don't know that you can break it down to individual wins and losses, but when you watch him manage the games, I agree. There's really not anything in this day and age that's a good manager anymore. Like, this is a great manager because of the reach that the front office has into sort of meddling with a lot of stuff in pretty much every team. But they're bad managers. And Buck is, I think, showing his age. You can see it in the way that he deploys pitchers. David Peterson went out. I went to the Friday night game. David Peterson went out there, pitched four good innings. It was scoreless through four. They were facing Max Fried. Buck saw it as, oh, well, it's just the fifth inning. The rain was coming down. By the time that fifth inning ended, it was either an official game or a game that, you know, they would pause it or whatever if it was scoreless. But there was a chance to keep the Mets in that game. He could have went to the bullpen. He could have said, okay, this is the third time through the order for Peterson. This isn't going to work. But instead he said, well, Peterson's got to face 27 guys because that's the way I drew it up. And Peterson went out there and gave up four runs. It doesn't work. The way he's managing the team will not work because he doesn't understand leverage. And when you start getting into leverage situations is when you start losing, if you don't manage it correctly.
Yeah. I'm of two minds about this, because I'm someone who believes that, like, the primary purpose of a manager throughout a 162 game season is ego management. And there are a lot of veterans on this Mets team who all expect to play a lot because they're getting paid a lot of money to play. And if there were a manager in this position with less experience in managing those egos, like a Luis Rojas, for example, this would probably be going a lot worse for the Mets right now. But I also see the argument about the value of someone making effective in-game decisions. Because as we saw last year, for example, and I'm not putting this on Buck because I don't think there's anything Buck could have done at this stage in the season to salvage the Mets' success. But the season came down to a series against the Braves and a series against the Padres. And if your manager is the reason why you lose even a single game, if that single game happens in the wrong moment of the season, that's it. That's the season. And it doesn't matter if your team wins 101 games or not. If you can't take 2 of 3 against the Padres, you're out of the wild card round. And so I see it both ways. I sort of kind of wish there was like this caretaker position where it's obvious that Buck Showalter is the boss, the middle manager of 25 major league veterans who they all respect, who they all listen to. And then I kind of sort of wish there was that tactical manager who made the in-game decisions, but we haven't really made that separation yet. There may be clubs that do that, but the Mets don't seem to be one of those teams.
Yeah, I mean, if it comes down to one game, you know, that's the same thing I remember back in 2019. It came down to 3 games, and, you know, it was, oh, well, this game in September. It could have been any 3 games over the course of the season. Last year, it could have been any 1 or 2 games over the course of the season that would have given them a better, if they'd won 1 game in that Cubs series that they got swept, that they had no business not winning any of those games, you know, that would have changed the outcome of the season. If this season comes down to 1 game, I mean, there's a real winner in terms of the doubleheader yesterday, the first game, running Denny Reyes out there for the second inning, and he gives up one more home run. I can't remember who Acuna hit his home run off.
But I think it was Curtis. It was just one more home. Still.
Okay, but still, that was a winnable game. They had Strider's number. They could have won that game. It came down to a run. It's poor in-game management. He never ended up using Adam Ottavino in that doubleheader. And of course, you can't anticipate like, oh, you know, I might need Ottavino for the second game. But at a certain point, you know, Tommy Hunter looked fine, but why are we doing Tommy Hunter for 2 innings? Why is Jeff Brigham going out there another inning? It's a lot of really weird bullpen management.
Yeah. Yeah. It's odd. And again, like I don't know how much the decision to pitch Denny Reyes, for example, is on Buck. I don't know how much of that is Epler. I don't know how much of that is the system. Whoever made that decision was not thinking about like winning a single game. There was probably more advanced thoughts to be made. But regardless of all of that, we have been told that the cavalry is coming. We're going to get our first start from Justin Verlander at some point in the coming days. And Max Scherzer should be coming back as well. I believe both of them are going to face off against the Tigers. They will probably have pitched by the time this episode airs. So we don't know how well they will have pitched by that time. But my question to you is, what can we expect from Scherzer and Verlander? Are they the saviors of this pitching staff? They're certainly paid as if they should be. And is that an expectation that we should set for two pitchers who are 40 plus, haven't looked very good in his first few starts in the case of Scherzer, and hasn't pitched in the regular season yet in the case of Verlander?
I mean, Scherzer's going to be better than Jose Mudo, probably. Like, that's a reasonable expectation to make that trade-off is going to go there. Verlander, we don't know, but his entire career has indicated, you know, he was pitching at the age of 39 last year. If you're going off of the track record, even just the last few years as he's gotten older, he's someone who knows how to change with his body. As he gets older, he knows how to adapt. And I think that's going to be very interesting. Really, the main thing for both of them is just going to be health. I mean, we saw it with Scherzer last year. He got hurt a lot, including right at the end of the season, probably pitched hurt during that playoff series. Verlander, you know, this was his first injury other than Tommy John and the one he had in 2005. He's getting older. This might just be a thing now. I don't think you can lay all your hopes and dreams on them, but I think that in both cases, adding them to the rotation is going to be an upgrade from what we've had. So I don't see how it can get any worse.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think logically, it's probably it's not the best idea to think that like this is going to lead to the Mets turnaround. But I can also understand from a Mets fan's perspective of these are the two highest paid players in baseball from an average annual value standpoint, and if they don't pitch like the two aces that they're expected to be, then what exactly is this season going to look like? And I think that is what worries me the most. I shared this with you before the season began. The thing that worried me the most about this team was all of their starting pitchers that they were going to expect to rely on for 30 starts or old. And we may not get 20, 25 out of any of them. And that's the thing that I feared the most that is manifesting so far in the first month, and it is just the first month, to say that this is going to continue for the rest of the season is, you know, something that I can't guarantee. But yeah, that's what I worry about. I've been very encouraged by the bullpen. I'm not worried about the offense in the slightest. I think that this is obviously a very good hitting team. But when you score 8 runs against the Braves, it doesn't really matter if the pitching gives up 9.
Yeah, I mean, this could even just be part of the cavalry. You know, it could be, okay, we get them back, and then come the trade deadline, there's going to be starters who are available. Even past, you know, obviously, dream big, shoot for the stars, it's Shohei Ohtani, but Lucas Giolito could be available. This is his last year of his contract. Corbin Burns could be available, probably cost a little bit more because he's got another year past this one. You know, even relievers. Liam Hendricks looks like he's going to be back before the end of May. Could be available. There could be pieces that are available on the market for not much that could be the final piece of the cavalry. Your Yoenis Cespedes trade in 2015, the final piece that pushes you to the end. It could be that this year it's a starting pitcher and they need to trade for someone. You don't know. This could just be the beginning of it. I mean, also the lineup wasn't looking too hot, and then the cavalry came when Beatty and Alvarez showed up because both of them have been looking better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I do think that this May schedule that we see a lot of games against the Rockies and the Tigers and the Nationals, like this is a time for the Mets to retool, to rack up some wins against some pretty easy opponents. I'm not going to do the thing where I predict they will take 2 out of 3 against the Nationals like I did last week, because that blew up in my face. So I'm just going to say that I hope they do well against the Tigers, and hopefully this ship can be steered back on track.
Yeah, I hope they at least win the games I'm going to, because I'll tell you, 2 straight losses in those fashions have not been fun. We are pretty close to the little bit past, not as past as we've been in the past weeks, a little bit past our little time limit we give ourselves. So why don't we take a break, and we'll be right back with some different topics.
This week on Get Hench, we're talking to top athletes about how they remain at the top.
Hey, Sergey, wait up! Sergey!
Carl, why are you here?
I saw you run out of the house. What are you doing?
I'm running.
Yeah, but what are you running from? The cops.
No, I'm running and listening to our podcast.
You're going to need a better alibi than that, bro. Hey? I'll get your passport, and I know a guy who can get us a car. After that, we're on our own.
No, I just want to listen to my podcast.
Don't wombat it, meerkat it.
Simples.
And we are back. Grace, you know Dwayne Wade, right?
Yeah, of course.
Are you familiar with what Dwayne Wade said about his housing situation in the past week or so?
Yeah, I didn't see the full statement, but I did see sort of the general gist of it, that he's getting the hell out of Florida.
Yeah, his family actually, I believe, moved out of Florida in 2021, so they've been out for the past couple of years. And I don't have the specifics about it, but what I do know is that he was conducting an interview where the interviewer asked him if a reason why he and his family moved out of Florida was because of that state's anti-trans stances and legislation. And Dwayne Wade unequivocally said yes, that it was something that they weighed in their decision to sell their house in Miami and to live full time on the West Coast. And I had some ambivalent feelings about it because I had a mix of joy, of success, but also of sadness and resignation. And so before I get into my feelings, I want to know how, like, what strikes you as the most interesting thing about Dwayne Wade, like, just flat out saying, Florida sports hero that he is, yeah, I just can't live in Florida anymore because, like, my family's safety comes as my top priority.
I mean, you just hit the nail right on the head. He's from that his basically his entire successful career, Hall of Fame career, took place in Miami. He went to Chicago for a season, but then went back to Miami. Like, he is a Miami Heat through and through. It's got to be sad for him, at least, that and him and his family, they lived there. They spent their entire lives, you know, there while he was playing and everything like that. Good for him that he's getting out. And what I love about Dwayne Wade, and something I like a lot about the NBA in particular, is that they are, in terms of the major sport leagues, the most of the men's sports leagues, I'll say, because the women's sports leagues are always great with, like, social issues. They're the most vocal about these social issues. Mm-hmm. So it's great to hear someone of his stature speak out about this. And I get the feeling of resignation too, that basically at this point, the only solution that you can see right now is to move, because it's not getting any better. It's just not getting any better. But everything that's been happening, it's going to take a little while at least for it to get better before it gets worse. It's got to be sad, but I commend him and Gabrielle Union for both the activism that they have been doing in the past however many years since Zara is his daughter's name, right?
Zaya.
Zaya. Since Zaya came out and everything like that, they've been doing amazing work, and they seem like such lovely people. Like, it's just great to see them. But good on them for basically putting Zaya's health and wellness first.
Yeah, huge shout out to the Wade Union family. One thing I want to point out about the family dynamic is that I'm someone who follows the NBA pretty closely, and I know two things about Zaya Wade. I know that she's a Wade and that she is trans, and that is it. Those are the only things I know about her, and that's how it should be. Like, these are two parents that obviously care very much about not just doing right for their daughter, but also protecting her identity and protecting her safety at all costs. And I think this move is a measure of that. And I do think there is some context that needs to be included here. Like every NBA family, they live in Los Angeles. Dwayne Wade is the host of a TV game show I've never seen. Gabrielle Union is an actor. Wade also, I believe, is a part owner of the Utah Jazz. And so living on the West Coast just makes a whole lot of sense for them. And so, like, when Wade says that this decision was weighed in part by Florida's anti-trans stance, I believe that. I don't believe that it was, like, the key reason why they just happened to live in a $20 million mansion in the Hidden Hills. Like, they're a wealthy family that would probably just want to live in Los Angeles anyway, because that's the spot for their careers. But I also felt a lot of sadness in this idea that Dwayne Wade, who in my estimation is probably the most decorated athlete in the history of South Florida sports, simply can't live in South Florida, says that, like, this place that hosted all of my greatness is too hostile for my family to live in. And it's not just sad for me to think about that on a family level, but it's also sad for me to think about that on a state level, to think that, oh, this, all of this anti-trans rhetoric, legislation, the point of all of it is to make sure that there's no trans people living in the state of Florida, whether that be by suppression or whether that be by making sure that they move out of the state. And it in that sense, it worked. Like, the state bullied a very wealthy and powerful family out of living in their state just because they were hostile to, you know, one of their children. So while I'm happy for the Wade family for making what I believe is a prudent decision about their family's safety, and also for just being very supportive and ideal allies in this space where they're very quietly fighting and supporting trans rights without ever putting their foot in their mouth. Like, it's amazing to me how, like, I've never heard a negative statement from Wade or Union, whether that be from ignorance or whether that be from malice. Like, they seem to be the ideal allies in this space. They're just killing it in that regard. But, like, yeah, I feel a couple of ways about it, but just glad they're in a good spot.
Yeah. I mean, I can't wait to see. I mean, the real thing here is going to be once Disney takes Florida to court. Sure. That is the one thing I cannot wait to see, because they don't realize the world of trouble that they are getting themselves into. And by they, I mean the state of Florida. Disney has more power than anything in this world. Like, that, it's crazy. As someone who generally dislikes Disney for their control over everything and their general conservative nature when they make their films, I can't wait to see them just absolutely demolish Ron DeSantis. It'll be fantastic. It's them and, like, that, and Meatball Ron as a nickname is just going to just kick the shit out of him for the next 3 years. But it does suck, because the thing is once you take him out of the equation, there's five more of him waiting behind him. Like, this isn't going to stop. And it's just, there is, if Dwayne Wade can't fight this problem, the man who made South Florida sports, who's going to be able to? Who's going to be able to step up and say, I'm not leaving, you're not going to bully me out of here? It does. There is, like, a sense of hopelessness there.
I favor Puddin' Fingers more than Meatball Ron, but I think that's just a me thing. But yeah, no, you're right. He's it's possible that we overvalue the cultural cachet of athletes just because we're sports fans. Maybe people don't actually care that Dwayne Wade is, like, leaving South Florida, or they just understand that, yeah, you're in the NBA, so you live in Los Angeles, because that's just what everyone does in the NBA. But yeah, it's definitely something that made me happy, made me sad. It's just queer existence right now, I guess. All right. Before we end this segment, I want to give a quick shout out to Zoe Zephyr with a Z. She is a legislator in the Montana State House, and she is suing the Montana legislature. I didn't know that you could do this. I didn't know that, like, you could be a state representative and then sue the state house. Anyway, Zoe Zephyr is a representative out of Missoula, Montana. She's the only trans representative in the Montana State House, and she is suing the state for what she believes is a censuring of her opposition to their multiple anti-trans bills. I want to give a shout out to Zoe Zephyr and tell her to fight the good fight and hope that she ends up, if not with a victory, with at least a lot of media attention. I know the ACLU is on her side, and so she's going to get a lot of money to fight this. But I think that's really cool. And I know that it is the results of some really hateful and bad shit going on. And if you live in Missoula, Montana, I believe you should be pretty angry that your representative is being silenced. But also, I think there's a lot of hope here, and there's a lot of support going to her, and I would like to lend our support as well.
This has been really wild to watch. Like, she's becoming, like, this modern folk hero in a way. Like, everything she does now is, like, big news. I saw her, she went out and sat on the bench because she wasn't allowed in the wherever they do that thing. I'm blanking on the words. But she's sitting out there on the bench. She's doing the work out there, and then the county clerk, the clerk inside the state house is like, yeah, I quit. I'm going to work for her. And then she goes back to Missoula and she gets, like, a hero's welcome. There's thousands of people standing out there cheering for her. Like, she just won first prize at the county fair. Like, it's crazy. And it's one of those things. It's disheartening that they would do this to her, but she's suing, and she's a really good case here, at least from my vantage point, that she's being silenced. And it's not just she's being silenced. It's not they're silencing one person. They're silencing a representative. That's what the whole country is based on, was our refusal to not have representation. And now you're basically saying, well, we don't like you. So all of the thousands of people that you represent, they don't get a representative now. It's crazy. She's, like you said, she's great. I love everything I've seen about her. She seems really thoughtful and really great at her job, that she's in there and she is just not, she will fight to last breath to make sure that these laws don't pass. And obviously they'd impact her as well, but it's not just her, it's people. These are real people that these laws affect.
Yeah. If you're trans and you make it that high in government, you have to be pretty extraordinary. Like to be able to overcome all of the obstacles that it takes to get at least a plurality of people in your district to say, yep, I want you to represent me and my thoughts, even though like you don't look or sound anything like the majority of people in my district. Like, yeah, you kind of have to be an extraordinary person. And I think the one thing I did not expect from this fight against anti-trans legislation on the state level is for me to know the names of state representatives outside of I don't know state representatives in my own state. I couldn't tell you who I send to Sacramento to represent me, but I know the names of Justin Jones and Justin Pearson, who both represent Memphis. And I know the name of Zoe Zephyr, who represents Missoula. I've never been to those cities. I don't have any interest in going to those cities. The fact that I know their names at all, but also know what they stand for, that's a huge thing. That's a huge win for these people.
It reminds me a lot of, I don't know if you remember this, this is going back, I think, 10 years now at this point, Wendy Davis, whose name I still remember,
right,
from the Texas state legislation, where she filibustered for days trying to stop an anti-abortion bill. These people, when they do these things, when these representatives stick to their guns and represent their people and their values, the values that they have been elected to uphold, even in the face of such difficulty and such hatred, when they continue to do this, they take on a life of their own. Much like, I mean, it doesn't end great. The story of this doesn't end great. But much like Harvey Milk. We all still remember Harvey Milk's names. And he was just a legislator in California who, he didn't have any effect on me in New York. I wasn't even born at the time.
Right.
But these people become heroes because they are so driven to protect and to uphold the people that they are elected to serve.
Yeah. Shout out Zoe Zephyr. Hope that all the money and support comes your way. We're going to take a break, come back with our third act. Don't go anywhere. I don't expect you would go anywhere, but I'll do that anyway.
All right. And we are back. It's act three now. Christian, did you see the Mariners City Connect uniforms that just came out?
I did. Black pants. That's what I remember about them.
So I'm gonna have a hot take here. I actually like the black pants with that jersey. Like, I wouldn't like them in other scenarios, but the color scheme and the racing stripes on the pants, I don't know. I'm a fan of the pants with that jersey. I don't like the Dodgers ones, the all blue ones. I think those look terrible. The black pants with that jersey, I think, look great.
Oh, I like the Dodgers City Connect uniforms, but I also like just about all of the City Connect uniforms. Like, the City Connect uniforms that I wasn't so hot on initially, I've come around to them. I think that baseball uniforms, while beautiful and a big reason why I like baseball in general, have been pretty stale and stayed over the past 50 years or so too. So to see all of this color, to see all this ingenuity coming out in these, even if some people don't like them, I'm so happy to see all of this. But yeah, Seattle, I amongst the pack, I would grade it at like a mid. Like, I don't think it's as like colorful and boisterous as San Diego's, for example. I really, really love what San Diego did with their like vaporwave beach City Connect uniforms. But I also don't think it's like as like classically like on point as the Angels. I love the Angel City Connect uniforms. And I think part of the reason why I love the Angel City Connect uniforms is because they're so much better than their regular ones. Like, if I look at your City Connects and I think to myself, that should be your full-time high Marlins, high Angels, high Rockies, then like you did a good job. So I'm a big fan of just about all the City Connect uniforms. Seattle, like, I think they did a good job. Let me see it on the field before I you know, make a final call on it.
Yeah, the pictures I've seen, again, they haven't won them on the field yet, so final decision pending. But pictures I've seen, I really like them, but that's because they're kind of half throwbacks to the old Trident jerseys, which I think are so awesome. I love a throwback jersey. The Phillies powder blues, absolutely adore them. Any team's powder blues. I would like a Mets powder blue if they could ever do one. They've never done one before, but I'd wear it. I'm a Mets black jersey fan, so I love a fun, different jersey. San Diego's is great. I loved the Washington ones with cherry blossoms. I think those look great. The Angels ones, you are correct, are the best jerseys that they wear generally. I can't really think of any that I truly did. I'm not a huge fan of the Rangers ones that just came out. I just think the logo on the chest is a little busy, but like none of them I hate. Like none of them, like, ugh, get that off of them. Most of them I like. I'm interested to see, because this year we're getting, I know we still have, I think, the Orioles, the Pirates. I want to say there's one or two others we're getting this year. We're not getting the Mets this year. I'd love to see what they're going to end up doing for the Mets, because I genuinely, there's a lot of stuff they could mine there, but I also feel like it very quickly could move from the realm of like looking really cool to looking really ugly.
Yeah. I don't exactly know what to expect out of the Mets here, because the one thing I'm super happy about is that the Wilpons do not own the team right now, because the City Connect uniforms would be blue and they would say Brooklyn on them. And I don't necessarily think that's the worst thing, but it would be entirely uncreative. There was a lot of talk, maybe in the wrong spaces, but a lot of talk about how the Mets City Connect uniforms, if and when they ever come to be, should use the iconography of the New York MTA, and specifically the 7 line, perhaps make something with purple as the primary color to reflect the color of the 7 line. And this seems to be a predominant desire of Mets fans online about how they want the City Connect uniform to look like. Is that something that you're on board with?
I think if it's done right, it could look cool, but I don't, because that lettering is like, you could really get weird, like it could get weird real quick with that and like not look super great, because it's very like typeface, regular font that you'd find in almost like a computer, the MTA font.
Right.
I feel like they could do something cool with like the skyline. I think that would be cool on a jersey. Like across the chest, I think the skyline would look really hot.
I don't know if you saw this, but there was a Mariners fan that posted on Twitter the City Connect uniforms as they currently are, but instead of it saying Seattle across the chest, it was the outline of the skyline from the Frasier logo. And I thought it looked incredible, that's exactly how it should be. And the Mets already have a template for that. They have the skyline in their primary logo. To simply paste that on a black jersey, maybe have the skyline in neon colors to sort of reflect the players outside of Shea Stadium, I think that would be a really interesting idea. Something with no words, just skyline. It's obviously the Mets, but something that's different, that's representative of New York. Because here's the other thing about the Mets City Connect uniforms that I think people aren't taking into account. The Yankees aren't going to have one. Like, the Yankees will be the last team. They're going to have to be dragged into a design room to figure out what a third uniform will look like, because they are so connected to their two jerseys that they don't even want to consider it. So the Mets City Connect uniforms, they have the potential to represent, you know, not just Queens, but all of New York City. This is one time where the Mets can claim all of the city, because the Yankees sure aren't going to do it. So that skyline idea, I think, can work really, really well.
And I mean, you were saying with the neon stuff like Shea Stadium, you could do something cool with that, with like the names and numbers on the back. Because they've shown with these City Connects that they will change the fonts on the back and have them be really cool and stuff. You could do something like that and make it look like the neon signs that were outside Shea Stadium. There's a lot of really interesting stuff that they can go with that isn't just the MTA, so that way when I look at the jerseys, I don't just think of the smell of piss.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to a 7-line jersey. But there are two things that I want to like point out. A, the Nets did this last year. The Nets, their third jersey used the MTA Helvetica font. It had the circle on the numbers, and they looked really good. They were my favorite Nets jerseys that I've seen, but it wouldn't strike anyone as creative. And the other thing is that the Boston Red Sox also did this too. Like, their yellow and blue jerseys are a tribute to their own metro system. And so the Mets doing it 3 years after the Red Sox introduced theirs, by the way, that's a beloved jersey. I still see it all the time at Red Sox games. Like, fans are wearing the yellow jersey like nothing. I don't think it's the most creative approach. I do think it's the one that best represents Queens. And if that's something that the Mets really, really want to lean into, like, we're not necessarily a New York team, but we are very much a Queens team, then I think that's a very safe decision. But I do think there are better options.
It's fun that the Boston fans love those jerseys. I actually like those jerseys, but I know a lot of people really hate those jerseys. I think they look nice. I think the color scheme is nice. I mean, it's not the Boston color scheme, but how many of these teams' jerseys actually match what their color schemes are? They're just cool. Yeah, I mean, like you said, I saw those Nets jerseys. Those Nets jerseys are really cool looking. But again, like you said, with that and the Boston ones paying tribute to the subway line, how original is the Mets doing the 7-line? Also, the 7-line specific jerseys might encourage the wrong people. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say by name, but I do find them very annoying, and I don't want to give them anything more to be encouraged by. But yeah, I genuinely, in my head, if I were to create the City Connect jerseys for the Mets, it would be Skyline first. If they want to put Queens across, like you said, you could just leave it blank after that and it'd be fine. They probably want to put something across the front. If they put like Queens across the front, it'd probably look cool. There's a lot of really interesting stuff. I know, I think Athlete Logos did one where he had on the sleeve was like neon designs of like players like they used to have outside Shea Stadium. That would look really cool. There's a lot of really interesting directions you could take the Mets ones.
I agree. That would be my top choice. But here's my second choice. Hear me out. It's going to look really ugly, but hear me out. I'm conceiving a jersey that is constructed exactly like the home run apple, with a green hat, a red shirt with the Mets circle logo in the middle, and black pants with the word home run emblazoned across the crotch.
You say that would look really ugly, and I feel like a lot of people would agree with that statement. I would buy about 10 of those, like full top to bottom. I'd be dressed like that. That would be so awesome.
It's the one piece of like iconography that you can attribute to the Mets. It's the apple, like maybe Mr. Met as well. But other than that, the Mets don't have a visual representation that is more evocative than the apple. And so I don't think they're going to go in this direction. But I would highly encourage that they consider it.
I mean, Mr. Met, have them all come out in gigantic heads. That would be fun too. Let's get crazy.
Yeah, I'd love it too. Grace, you got a movie for us?
I sure do. So I went and saw, so I've been trying to catch up this week. I've been a little bit behind on the 2022 releases. Life got in the way. But I've been catching up. And I saw this movie this week called How to Blow Up a Pipeline. It debuted at TIFF last year, and then it came out a few weeks ago. It's kind of mostly out of theaters. You might still be able to find it in like larger metropolitan areas. It's about this group of people who all have their different reasons for it. They decide to commit eco-terrorism and blow up a pipeline to sort of send a message. This movie, it's like a 70s thriller, kind of like a, almost like a, this is the 70s, but like the Safdie brothers with Uncut Gems and Good Time, kind of like that, like feeling very gritty, really looks like it's shot on film. It looks great. The score is incredible. I was blown away by this. I'm not someone who sits on the edge of my seat watching a movie. If I'm really like, I don't really get into it that much because I do have like sort of a two-way removed from the movie where I'm like watching for both technique and the story. I was on the edge of my seat watching these people try to blow up this pipeline. And it's one of those things where you're like, are they going to die doing this? Are they going to get caught? And there's a twist at the end that I didn't see coming and went from like 4.5 to 5 stars, in my opinion, my favorite movie of the year thus far. It's got a great cast. I don't know if you're familiar, Ariella Barr, who is in, I'm probably mispronouncing her name, I'm sorry. She was in The Runaways, the Marvel TV show. I didn't watch it. I read those comic books. She was in a couple episodes of One Day at a Time, the first season when it was on Netflix. She's been a couple other things. She is the lead and she co-wrote it. I would have never guessed that she would, I mean, I thought she was a great actress. She seemed really cool, but I never would have thought that her first thing that she would have actually worked behind the scenes in that capacity would be something this awesome, like this, like really cool and kind of outsider. Sasha Lane, who I've loved in literally everything I've ever seen her in. She was in American Honey and Hearts Beat Loud and The Miseducation in Cameron Post, which I didn't love because I loved the book so much and I thought it wasn't a great adaptation, but she's great in it. Forrest Goodluck, who was also in The Miseducation of Cameron Post. He was in The Revenant. Lucas Gage, who's like a big thing now. He's everywhere. He's in this movie. It's a crazy cast. The movie is so good. Like, I want to tell everyone to see this movie.
My interaction with this movie, or how I learned about this movie, was thus. I watched a trailer on Twitter for the Blackberry movie. I don't know what it's called. And I came away, it's just called Blackberry. I came away from that thinking, this is just brand. This is a movie about a brand. Cool. Not interested in the slightest. The very next one was How to Blow Up a Pipeline. And I'm like, how did these trailers come back to back in my Twitter feed? Because they are the opposite movie. And I'm so glad that you enjoyed it. You say it's your favorite movie of the year. It came out in 2022, though. Does that mean it's your favorite movie of 22 or 23?
Looking it up, it'll say 2022 because it premiered at the TIFF, at the Toronto International Film Festival.
Oh.
But it actually didn't come out in theaters stateside until about a month ago.
Very nice.
Yeah. I haven't seen a ton of movies this year, so obviously that can change, but it is my first 5 out of 5 movie of the year. Like, I think it's incredible. Can't wait to rewatch it. The best word to call it is, like, you know, in the trailer, gripping, exhilarating, stuff like that. You think it's bullshit. It's not. This movie is insane.
How many 5-star ratings do you give per year?
Anyway, I watch a lot of movies a year. So thinking back, every year I usually, of the new releases, I usually see... This is going to be a big number. I usually see around 100 to 130 new movies each year from that year. I usually give out somewhere in the vicinity of like 10 to 15. So like solid 7 to 10% of the movies. I'm easier to get on the 5-star rating, but I do think there's like a delineation in my 5-star ratings. There's 5-star ratings where I think it's actually a 4 out of 5, but I just had such a good time watching it. And then there's 5-star ratings where I'm like, this is incredibly made. I put How to Blow Up a Pipeline in both, but more the incredibly made and also just such a fun time in the theaters. So right now it's number one. I genuinely don't see it dipping below number 10, quite honestly, unless a ton of stuff blows me away this year, but I really do see it staying in my top 10.
All right. Well, I'm hoping my local art house cinema will show it because I am interested in watching this. I also love a movie that just tells you exactly what it's about in the title. Beautiful stuff there.
Yeah, it's based on a book too. I haven't read the book. I looked at my local library, and unsurprisingly for where I live, not a single library stocks the book called How to Blow Up a Pipeline. So I'm gonna probably have to buy it. But weirdly, it's one of those movies that's based on a book, but it's based on a nonfiction, non-narrative book. Like, the book, from my understanding, is basically like convincing people that the only way forward might just be at least extreme activism, if not to the point of eco-terrorism. But it works. They Ariella Barr and Daniel Goldhaber, who directed the film, found a narrative out of this book and made it into a great movie.
I also quickly have a story about local library tendencies. The book Winning Fixes Everything about the Houston Astros cheating scandal. There are, I believe, 17 copies in my city's local library system and 25 different ebook copies as well. And they are all reserved for the next 6 months because I live in Los Angeles and Dodgers fans really, really want to read this book.
What's funny is I live in New York. I live on Long Island. There's a lot of Yankee fans who you would presume want to read this book. I had it on because my local library system, which is for the entire county, there's maybe like 30 libraries in the county, 30 or 40. I think out of all of those, maybe there were two copies, if two, maybe just one. I had it on request. I wasn't anticipating getting it for several months just because, you know, someone had checked it out, and a lot of times the local libraries are restrictive on who gets to take out their new books first. I guess I just had it on hold for so long that my library asked for a copy, so I ended up getting it within like a month of the book coming out. When you do get a chance to read it, it's fantastic. But yeah, I bullied my library into getting the book for me.
Nice. I wish I had that power as well. I do have hardcover copies available at my local bookstore, but what I don't have is $32. And so I'm waiting for a paperback or a free copy from the library to open up. And with that, I think we can end this week's episode. Grace, do you have any parting ideas?
Sure. Hoping they win some games against the Tigers and Rockies, especially Friday night when I will be attending the game. Other than that, love the kids, love Brett Beatty and Francisco Alvarez, and let's go, Mets.
Yeah, I'm happy they're playing up to their competition. Hopefully they don't play down to their competition either. So let's go, Mets. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next week.